If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Something that might be seen as eccentricity or outlandish behavior in current society or in previous society, sometimes we just need to take a little time to reflect on the way that people behaved. And then we can actually see that many of these people were pioneers. They were just ahead of their game.
That was David Bramwell discussing some of history's most unusual inventors.
And they were trying to bring back, give back to people a purpose in their work and joy in labour.
And that was Rosalind Ormiston, on location at an important site for the arts and craft movement.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe. Or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our fourth podcast of November 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with the author and BBC radio presenter David Bramwell. David is the co-author, along with Joe Keeling, of a new book entitled The Auditorium, which charts the careers of a group of unconventional inventors through history. Our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorne, caught up with him recently to find out more.
Along with Joe Keeling, you're one of the authors of a new book called The Auditorium, which recounts the tales of 48 compelling individuals driven by obsession, curiosity, trickery, courage and gumption. Can you give us a little flavour of the book and the type of people that are in it?
Well, we've broken the book into different chapters. I think one of the hardest things was finding the chapter headings. So we've looked at tricksters and subversives, creative mavericks. There's a chapter called Wild at Heart, which was about adventurers and people with great courage who overcame great difficulties, pioneers and inventors, and the last one, which is explorers of the mind, which was more about philosophers. And we also touch upon people who venture into the world of psychedelics. And how that has impacted on society as well.
But all the people covered are eccentric, or what we would now maybe see as outsiders.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we were very cautious about when we started the book was that it wasn't just going to be a regular book of eccentrics. In fact, there's a really lovely introduction by John Mitchinson from Unbound. And his introduction to the book talks about some vicar from Cornwall many years ago who turned up was a local character. He insisted that the congregation the locals in the village become vegans. He was very didactic about what they should do, what they couldn't do, and eventually he sort of drove everybody away. And so in response, he made cardboard cutouts of the congregation, which he put in place of where they would have been. And he put barbed wire fencing around the church. And John said, this is such a lovely story of eccentricity, but he's not in the book. And the reason he's not in the book is because he didn't change the world. He didn't impact on the way that we see the world or change the way that we see the world. And that's what all these people have in common, that something that might be seen as eccentricity or outlandish behavior in current society or in previous society, sometimes we just need to take a little time to reflect on the way that people behaved. And then we can actually see that many of these people were pioneers. They were just ahead of their game. So one character that springs to mind is Dr. William Price. And Price was around at the late part of the 19th century. And he was a doctor in a Welsh village. He was very respected, but he was also into paganism. He became a druid. He began dressing in what looks like, from the photos, a very early form of the onesie, and which was covered in runic symbols. And he carried a staff, and he was a vegetarian and a naturist. But he was very concerned about the lifestyle of the villagers. And because this was the Industrial Revolution, he saw that a lot of ill health. He believed that a lot of the ill health was coming from the way people were living. They were being worked too hard. They were suffering from diseases related to pollution and the industry they were in. And so he approached their health from a holistic point of view. He recommended dietary changes. He recommended more fresh air and walking. He wouldn't treat smokers. He said that smokers were not looking after themselves. I mean, this is incredible pioneering thinking for the turn of the last century. He also, at the age of 83, sired his first child and decided to call him Jeezy Crees, Jesus Christ in Welsh. Sadly, the child died only a few months after it was born. So he took the body up to the top of a local mountain and cremated his son's body, which at the time was illegal. And so he was arrested, and he defended himself in court, and he spoke about the environmental impact of only burying bodies. He talked about how in different parts of the world it was okay for bodies to be cremated, and he changed the law. You know, the body was allowed to be cremated, and the law changed. This was 1902. So you've got these. He's a classic example, I think, of the characters in the book. You know, this very strong-willed individual who wanted to live his own way, or, you know, characters live in her own way, and he made a change, not a huge, not a global change, but a small but significant change in the way we live, in the way we see the world, and that is at the heart of the characters in this book. And I think obsession was the word we kind of landed on. Obsession is something which can be something which, well, you know, we think of dictators, and we can think of people committing terrible crimes in history as being obsessives. But there is a good side to obsession as well, in that it makes us single-minded. It takes us on a path, and for the characters in the book, it is largely a celebration of obsession. Although we have put people in the book who had a detrimental impact on the planet as well, because it didn't seem fair to only just talk about people who created positive change, but also those that created, you know, negative change as well.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke there a bit about obsession. What else are your main criteria for being a pioneering eccentric?
I think just living a life that seems contrary to the way that other people do, something that is considered outside of the norm. And I became really obsessed with, really fascinated by, and really sort of fell in love with you know, his attitude was Quentin Crisp. Now, 20, 30 years ago, I think that Quentin Crisp's name would have been pretty well known, but I think that it's a name that's sort of fallen out of fashion, and I think, you know, sort of the next generation probably wouldn't know who he was. But Crisp was a flamboyant gay man who stepped out into London society in the late 1920s, wearing nail polish and dyed hair and colourful flamboyant clothes. And his attitude was, I will not fit into society. I will be myself, and I will wait for society to form around me. And that was a very courageous thing to do, because, of course, you know, he received violence. He was verbally abused. He was spat upon. And how prescient that he, you know, he went from being, as he said, a social pariah to being a celebrity, to being someone who was sought out for his opinion on lifestyle, about how we should live. You know, he became a great monologuist, a great sort of TV chat show host. And what was also very curious was that these are his words. He said, as a gay man, I just want to be invited. Welcome to the party. And the party for him was the mainstream. It was the heterosexual culture he saw around him. But then he added afterwards, I never imagined that queer culture would end up hosting some of these parties. So, you know, in his own lifetime, he saw this great transformation from being someone who was an outsider in society to part of a group, a minority, who actually not only just accepted by society, but actually cultural pioneers, societal pioneers.
So it's in many ways people who are just really ahead of the curve.
Yes, I think largely ahead of the curve, or just doing things their own way. I mean, Ivor Cutler's another one, that someone whose work I adore. And maybe it wouldn't be fair to say that Ivor was ahead of the curve, but just doing something completely different to everybody else. I mean, no surprise that you know, Ivor had more Peel sessions than any other artist.
And he was a poet.
He was a poet. He was a songwriter. He wrote children's books. There was also something very Dadaist about the way he went about life. I think about Gilbert and George and the way that they sort of embody their art. It's a performance. And with Ivor, it was a performance as well. He would travel around London on his bicycle wearing plus fours and a big hat with flowers in his hat. And he made stickers. He called them stickies. And they had his own aphorisms that he would put on these stickers. And there's a lovely story about when he got on a bus one day, and the bus driver was having a bad, bad day, and he was yelling at one of the people getting on the bus. And Ivor silently reached forward with one of his stickers, and he put it on the driver's lapel. And the driver, with a face of thunder, looked down, and the sticker said, "You are beautiful." And he burst into giggles. And you know, what a wonderful and unusual thing to do. You know, this was the kind of man Ivor was. So I don't think he was a pioneer, but he lived a very playful kind of life. And I think one of the lines that he said was in one of his radio programs, the interviewer said, "Ivor, why have you never grown up?" And his reply was, "I've been busy."
So how did you go about uncovering or compiling all of these characters? Where did you find them?
I would say many of the ones that I wrote about were people that already interested me and fascinated me. Some of whom, a small number of them I'd met, like Falco Tarasacco and Ken Campbell. Others through word of mouth, through research, through friends, and also we had 12 contributors to the book as well. So there's quite a lot of the characters came from writers and from artists. We had people like Sir Tim Smits, who set up the Eden Project. We had Richard Turner, who's a Radio 4 producer. We had Sarah Anglis, who's a musician and roboticist. So someone like Sarah unearthed a story about an Eastbourne housewife called Muriel Howarth, who was into atomic gardening in the 1950s and was into trying to solve world hunger by looking for mutant plants, if seeds are irradiated, if they're blasted with atoms, then one in a million can become a mutant seed that will not be bad to eat, but would potentially be enormous. It's a bit like looking for a needle in a haystack. And she was never successful in finding these mutant seeds, but she was thinking ahead of the game. And actually, 60, 70 years on from Muriel, people are now looking back at this way of actually, you know, modifying food. And obviously it's controversial because we have mixed feelings about the idea of genetically modified produce. But you know, here was someone on their own, just fascinated by the atomic age and exploring it as an individual. And we would never have found out about Muriel Howarth without someone like Sarah Anglis, who wrote about her. And Sarah is someone who researches unusual people from history, particularly women. And so, you know, we're very grateful to have such a broad team of writers bringing ideas to us.
Yeah, because Muriel, like you say, is just one of the kind of remarkable and unusual women in the book. Another one is Elaine Morgan, who I found very intriguing.
I love Elaine Morgan. Yes, I was so happy, so delighted to be able to include her. And here was a woman challenging our preconceived ideas of our evolutionary history. She was challenging the savanna theory that the reason why we became bipedal, the reason why we lost our hair, was because we came down from the trees and we started lobbing spears around in the savanna. And she, you know, she looked at this with a cool eye and said, it's a very male-centric view of evolution, this. Why is it that men are generally more hairy than women? If it was the men who needed to lose the hair to do the running around to cool the body down whilst they were lobbing spears. And if the women were, as was perceived at the time, sitting under the trees and looking after the young, well, so what? All their hair fell out as well just because the men's needed to? It doesn't really add up, this. Now, she didn't come up with this theory. This was a theory that had been around for a number of decades, but no one had been brave enough to actually step forward and put it, you know, sort of to the scientific community and to the public for fear of being ridiculed. Scientists, you know, they do fear their status if they put forward an idea which seems you know, ridiculous at the time. So she wrote about it extensively. She did a book called The Aquatic Ape Theory. She wrote a book called The Descent of Women, Descent of Woman, and became a bit of a celebrity at the time. But she was poo-pooed by the science community. They said, you know, you're a woman, you're a feminist, you're not a scientist, we're not going to take this seriously, you haven't done any proper research, it's all, you know, it's all speculative research, speculative theories. And in recent years, Sir David Attenborough has taken up the cause, and he has gone looking for more hardcore evidence to back up the aquatic ape hypothesis, as it's now known. In fact, it's the waterside hypothesis, as it's now been called.
So it seems like with people like Elaine Morgan, one of the key things about being a pioneer is being brave or not really caring what anyone thinks about you.
Indeed, and of course, there's always the danger that you're wrong. You can live a whole life believing, you know, the Earth is flat, or being a solipsist, or, you know, having a particular worldview which actually, you know, is later proven to be nonsense. In fact, I was reading recently about the Guinness World Record holder for Nessie spotting, but a gentleman who'd been residing in a caravan by Loch Ness for 24 years. Waiting for the chance to photograph Nessie and therefore prove that she existed. And after 24 years, he packed up his binoculars and he left his caravan and he went home announcing to the press, if there ever was anything there, it was probably a catfish or something. And so, you know, there's someone who was very fixed, very obsessive about a particular thing. He wanted it to be true, but sadly, you know, in the age of the mobile phone, we know that if there was Nessie, if there was Bigfoot, by now it would have been captured with you know, with someone's camera. So, I mean, there, you know, there's obsession that sadly doesn't lead to cultural change, but just leads to maybe a realization a bit late in life that you've been barking up the wrong tree. And not all of the people in the book are successful. We include Thomas Midgley Jr., whose tagline is "the worst inventor in history." This was the gentleman who put lead into petrol and claimed at the time that it wouldn't have any adverse effects. And he also put CFCs into aerosols and fridges. And then he ended up, sadly, strangling himself to death with a contraption that he'd built to get himself in and out of bed because he'd contracted polio. So his entire life was a disaster of inventions. It was important, we felt, to put in people like this as well, just to balance it up a bit.
As you say, obsession can be wrong-headed in those cases you've just mentioned. And you mentioned very briefly earlier that it can also be something that isn't necessarily for the positive, that it's not necessarily always admirable. And some people, I'm thinking of people that you mentioned, like Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. He was an eccentric, but he really was a fraudster in many ways.
I'm going to defend Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. I think he was a wonderful individual. I've no idea whether... I suspect that he probably did believe his own, you know, his own myth. But I think you have to doff your cap to a man who in 1956 fell out of a tree whilst owl spotting. He was an unemployed plumber. He put his back out, so he had no work. So what did he do? By leap of imagination, he reinvented himself as a Tibetan Lama. He wrote a book called The Third Eye, in which he claimed to have lived in Tibet and brought up in a Lama Suri, And you know, wrote about his adventures meeting yetis and yogic flying, etc. So obviously, and this book was a global bestseller. It is still the UK's best selling book on Tibet, and of course you could say that, well, it was just an act of fraud, and we should not be celebrating this man. But he went on to write 20 books, including one that he claimed was dictated to him by his Siamese cat. And there was, tellingly, there was an interview with the Dalai Lama, who Dr. Chusalopsam Rampa, aka Cyril Hoskin, claimed to have met on several occasions. When the Dalai Lama was asked about this, he said, "No, I've never met this gentleman, and I believe that his work, his books, are entirely works of fiction." But he added, "I believe that he's done a lot for the cause of freeing Tibet, because he drew a lot of attention to Tibet." And I have to say, I have a soft spot for people who play the role of the trickster. So I would defend Chusalopsam Rampa, because I just think there's just something wonderful about someone to have the audacity to write a book about a country that he'd never even visited. He didn't even own a passport. So I mean, trickery is, I think it's necessary for society. I mean, also because of the age we live in as well, it'd be very difficult for anyone to be able to pass themselves off as a llama, as this gentleman did, because we can find this information out very easily. So it's almost a story from the past that wouldn't really ever be able to happen again in our current age. So it's a nice little sort of snapshot of historic trickery.
Yeah, there's something nostalgic about some of these stories, isn't there? Like that you wouldn't get nowadays, and like the story of Reginald Bray, which is one of my favourites.
Me too. And so Reginald Bray was a Victorian. He was a trickster as well. And what I like about the story is that we don't think of the Victorians as having a sense of mischief. We think of them as being very, very uptight, very proper. But this was a gentleman who, in his late teens, when he'd become an accountant, he was an accountant for the whole of his life, a very, you know, regular, wholesome job. And he popped into his local post office, and he found that the post office had issued the very first manual for post office workers with all of the details, the ins and outs of how the system worked. It wasn't intended for public reading, but he bought it, read it from cover to cover, and treated it as a challenge. And within the book, he found out all sorts of quirks, like the smallest living thing you could then send through the mail was a bee. The largest was an elephant. And he began, he set up a, you know, he's in his spare time, he set up a life where he would dedicate his time to pranking the Royal Mail. He sent 30,000 singular objects through the mail during his lifetime. And he began by sending things like cigarettes and turnips, where he'd carved the address into the turnip, and a bowler hat, a frying pan. And then he turned his attention to living things. He sent his terrier Bob through the mail, and then himself, first by bike and then the second time on foot. Now, obviously, he wasn't put in a package. He was escorted by a postman or postwoman. But it's just a wonderful, you know, it's a wonderful story of trickery. He was the first person that we know who wrote to Father Christmas. We have evidence that he wrote to Father Christmas, I think, in 1902, and it wasn't until the 50s that the British Postal Service started to address the growing number of letters to Santa, admittedly not from grown-ups, but actually from children. So he was ahead of his game, and yes, I think it could be credited as artistic as well as tricksy.
It's often said that there's a fine line between genius and madness, as you will well know. Would you say that that's fair with the people that you've looked at?
Well, I'd have to come back to a quote from one of our characters, Ken Campbell, who was a maverick theatre director who died 7 or 8 years ago. And one of the maxims that he lived by was, if it's not impossible, it's not worth doing. And as a consequence, in creating theatre, he would make theatre productions that you would laugh about down the pub and say, yeah, that'd be great, but no, actually, it's not possible. And Ken, he staged the world's longest play, The Warp, which was 24 hours long. He did The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the audience were transported around on a giant hoverboard from stage to stage. He did one called The War of the Newts, where the audience were put into a swimming pool up to their waist, and the cast paraded around the swimming pool dressed as newts and sometimes interacted with the audience, you know, in the water. I say swimming pool, it was an abandoned warehouse that they filled with water. And the reason I mention this is because Ken was often described as mad. They'd say, oh, that mad Ken Campbell with his crazy giant eyebrows and his raspy voice. But Ken would retort, I'm not mad. I've just read different books to you. And I think there's something very, it may seem a flippant response, but I think there's something very, very true about that. You know, it is all relative. We think of people as being weird and not like us because they just act and think in a different way. But it's just, you know, they may have just read different books.
That was David Bramwell. The Auditorium is out now in the UK, published by Chambers. In the US, it's available for the Kindle. Meanwhile, the December issue of BBC History magazine is currently on sale. This month's edition includes articles on Edward I, the murder of Rasputin, the Klondike Gold Rush, medieval cities, Black British history, and plenty more. You can get hold of our December issue in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new subscribers in the United Kingdom, where you can pick a free book worth £25. To take advantage of this offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/HTP210. The offer ends on the 31st of December this year.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
One of the regular features we run in the magazine is History Explorer, where we visit a site of historical interest accompanied by a relevant expert. For our December issue, we paid a visit to Standon House in West Sussex, one of the jewels in the crown of the 19th century arts and craft movement. Joining our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, on location there was Rosalind Ormiston, co-author of William Morris, Artist, Craftsman, Pioneer. Let's hear how they got on.
Rosalind, for the uninitiated, what is the arts and craft movement?
What it was it was an influential movement of like-minded people who wanted to return to, well, not exactly the Middle Ages, but to the craftsmanship of the Middle Ages, bringing back silversmiths, woodworkers, because they felt that it was lost through the Industrial Revolution. Many people were coming from the country to the city and working in factories, and it was It wasn't the work was demeaning, but it was just, it had no purpose. And they were trying to bring back, give back to people a purpose in their work and joy in labour.
Okay, so was it sort of kind of a reaction to industrialisation in many ways then?
Yes, indeed. And also, I mean, when we think of arts and crafts, you think of architecture and obviously decorative arts and applied arts. And if I may, I just say it goes back to how the argument began, or the debate, was when they had from the 1820s, 30s, the style in Britain was classicism, particularly John Nash in London. And a man, an architect called Pugin, Augustus Welby, Northmore Pugin, was an architect. He was very angry about this because he said that if you look around Britain, churches look like temples, Greek temples, pagan buildings, our banks and hotels look like Gothic cathedrals. He said this is completely wrong. And so he wrote Contrasts, 1836, which was published, saying, look at the life of in the medieval period, and this is where it comes in, where they're going back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
That look at the lifestyle there, where the monasteries would feed the poor and nurture them and help people in the community, and you had guilds of workmen, apprentices. And then you look at the 19th century, where it's the factories and the people are still poor, living in terrible accommodation. And he contrasted the Middle Ages to the 1852, so yeah, the 1840s. And that sort of kick-started a whole raft of people that could do something about it, to actually do something about it and start looking at the design of our buildings, design of our arts and crafts.
Yeah. So did they see like a growing alienation between these designs and real people's lives?
Yes, and poor design. Absolutely. Right. The main thing was poor design. The 1851 exhibition really brought that home. Before that, they knew this because there were many expositions and exhibitions, and they could see that because you could manufacture anything, anything, wood, you could make your cupboards and furniture and wardrobes from it. They were just throwing in things. They'd throw a little bit of Egyptian this or a Greek that, without any thought of actually what the purpose of the furniture was. And it sort of just diluted this the craftsmanship of the past. And so when the 1851 exhibition came, and that was on for 6 months from May to October.
So this is a really high-profile event.
Absolutely,
wasn't it?
And it's international.
Yeah,
so you're getting production from America, from Australia, obviously from Europe. Everybody there, and the census was at the end of it, how appalling the taste was, or the design was.
So can you give me some examples of why they didn't like this?
I know there's one in the V&A actually. It wasn't manufactured, but it's because they could. They made a chair out of antlers horns. You couldn't sit on it. It was just it was ugly, totally unusable. And yet, because they could, they had the antlers horns. They think, oh, well, this is handcrafted, handmade. But in fact, it lost the objectivity, is the fact that if it's a chair, you want to actually use it. In amongst that comes the fact, well, what about how people are living as well?
Yeah.
And, you know, the looking at the industrialisation, the expansion of the Manchester, Liverpool, the factories, of course, the railways, all of this that's expanding, that actually what's happening to the people. And it's going back to that you know, that we've lost something from our past.
So what did they think was happening to the people? What was it that concerned them about industrialisation?
Well, it's because we were like the centre of the industrial nations at that time, that more and more people were coming from, well, this comes from the 1780s, coming from the countryside to the city.
Yeah.
But, of course, there's nowhere to live. They're living in poor conditions. You know, you just have to read something like Mayhew's London of 1850. They're living in cramped, sordid conditions, and they're working all hours, you know, to make money, and they're getting poorer and the rich are getting richer, the industrialists on this. And so there was a social problem as well.
Right.
So it wasn't just on what they were making. It was picked up by William Morris, a young man. Now, he didn't actually ever step inside the 1851 exhibition. He was brought up, when I say as a medievalist, but he had the most wonderful upbringing in the countryside in a large estate. He had his own pony, he had a suit of armour, parents made, had a suit of armour made for him. And he read from the age of 4 to 7, because he calls himself a sickly child. He actually read the Waverley novels, you know, and Walter Scott. So he's steeped in the Middle Ages. This is a period he loves.
So is he from quite a wealthy background?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, his father in the city, a wealthy background. And they lived a sort of, obviously a modern life, but also a medieval one. They made their own butter, their own beer. They had plenty of servants. And this is, so he's grown up with a lifestyle that actually does hark back. You can see many strands going back to how people did live. Sort of a community in his house, and lots of servants. And he rather likes that way of living. And he doesn't, so I say, he doesn't even step inside. Which I'm amazed at that still, that he didn't step inside to see what actually was in there. But at Oxford, he went up to study theology.
Yeah.
He met there Edward Burne Jones, who is one of the Pre-Raphaelite painters.
Yeah.
And he was introduced to Ruskin's book, and he read that. And it was a revelation that, you know, that it is truth to materials. You've got to be honest about what you're making. And the people count, you know, the guilds, the communes, this counts. And so he left to become, he thought, an architect, having read Ruskin on Gothic architecture.
Yeah.
And that's when he met the office in Oxford, the George Edmund Street, who's a Gothic revivalist architect of the law courts in the Strand. He met Philip Webb, and this was to be, this is the start of the arts and crafts movement, when they get together, architect and designer, and also Morris with his ideas of how he wants to have a better life for people.
So the arts and crafts movement, if there are, say, 3 or 4 signatures of that movement, what would they be?
Truth to materials. So you're making your furniture is from the local woods.
Yeah.
You've got a craftsman who's been apprenticed and knows how to make it.
Yeah.
And he makes it. It can take many hours, weeks to make a piece of furniture. But it's made to the highest standard of craftsmanship.
Right.
And this is what's brought back, is that the apprenticeship started to actually get people back into making traditional furniture, silverware. Particularly, silversmith, that the beauty is in what you're looking at, is that in how it's been made. And as what Morris said, you shouldn't have anything in your house that's not useful or beautiful,
right?
And preferably both.
So it's not something that just appears in a factory, then it's something you've actually designed.
It is because the joy, he said, was in the labour of making it.
Right.
And again, they're going back to the stonemasons of the Middle Ages, where you don't know who they are, although they'd have their mason's mark, is that the joy is actually in making the building, in the craftsmanship. Because if you go back to the Middle Ages, this is where the guilds are, that you apprenticed for 3 years or more. It depends on what you were apprenticed for. And then you became a master of the guild, you became a member, and then you they looked after you. So how much there'd be a contract, how much you're getting, what you're working on, and there was a pride in what you were doing, and that's what they wanted to bring back, a pride in what you're making, which of course factory work didn't have that, because you're just part of a line. But, well, how it then established itself, because Morris realised he's not going to be an architect. He then decided he was going to be a painter because of his connection with Edward Burne Jones and the Pre-Raphaelites, who were friends. He met one of the models from the Pre-Raphaelite circle, Jane Burden, and they got married. And so he needed a house. And this is how it really begins, from the Red House in Bexley Heath in the 1858, where he asked Webb to design a house for him. And they design it together, and it's going to be a vernacular house. It's going to be fit in to the English style of a traditional house. It's going to look organic. It's going to look as though you could add on. And he did mean to add on pieces to the house. He wanted a commune, really. He wanted Edward Burne Jones and his family to live there. He wanted it to be like a commune of friends.
Sure.
And so the house, Webb designed the house for that. And that's what sort of kick-started Webb's career as well, as an architect. But what they realised, they had painting parties, their friends would come down, the Pre-Raphaelites, let's say. But they realised they didn't have any furniture. There was nothing that they wanted to put. They wanted handmade furniture that fitted the period of the house.
Yeah.
Because it is sort of going back to the 1400s. That's what they wanted. And they couldn't find anything. So they decided there on the spur of the moment, one weekend house party to have a company. And this is how we get Maurice Marshall, Fulton and Co., all their skills coming into a company.
Yeah.
And that's when they decide, this is about 1860, 61, they go into the 1862 exhibition as a company, as a commercial company. They're making stained glass and ironwork and tapestries.
Right.
And they're getting, and this is where they get their customers from, mainly churches for the stained glass, but Edward Burne-Jones makes the stained glass. And so they're working together as a, it's like their own little commune, but they're working together in London as a group.
Yeah. And you said, you mentioned the 1862 exhibition. Can you just explain what that was?
Yes, so you have the 1851.
Yeah.
And so the 1862 is the follow-on to it.
Right, okay.
It's in the same sort of, it's in the same, actually the 1851 was in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
And it was a glass building because they hadn't really worked out what they're going to have. So they had a prefabricated large greenhouse, really. But by 1862, it's actually where the Natural History Museum is now. That's where they had the 1862 buildings.
Right.
And so this, again, was an international building.
Yeah.
And so you could show your wares there, you know.
Yeah.
And so Maurice Marshall Fulton had a stand there, and they had the medieval stand. And as it happened in the 1851 exhibition, it was Pugin who had the medieval stand with ironwork and stained glass.
Right. Okay.
So they're following on from Pugin, and it's all handcraft, handmade. But of course, it's expensive, and so it tends to be the church wardens or church builders who are, or not church builders so much as those that are wanting stained glass, that they're getting their orders from.
Yeah.
But from this, they're also meeting and networking. Maurice was a wonderful networker. And so, of course, the customers had to be wealthy, upper middle class, wealthy, or, you know, to actually sustain their business.
So this was all sort of gaining momentum now then.
It is. Yeah. And they did actually have a go at making furniture.
Yeah.
And it was just horrendous. It was like huge pieces of heavy wood, and so Maurice had to go at making it, and they realised he sort of had to farm that out, really. But again, that they had craftsmen to make it, and also that that you get. I mean, this by the well, this is the 1862 exhibition where it sort of starts off, and it's gaining momentum, and people are. Well, from the 1870s, there's guilds forming, Art Workers Guild, Century Guild, the Guild of Handicraft, people coming together.
These designs start appearing in the houses of the great and the good around Britain. Could you give me some examples of
Of course. Well, say that with Maurice and Co., let's say with that because they are at the forefront, that Philip Webb in, I think it's 1861, I should have to get my, he made a house for in One Palace Green, which is in Kensington Gardens.
Yeah.
He made that house, he designed that house for George Howard, the 9th Earl of Carlisle.
Rosalind.
And in fact, it fell foul of the planning, you know, the local council planners who didn't like the way it looked because it's red brick and stone, and again, it's local materials. He's making it. He's making a house that fits the purpose for what they want. They want a townhouse, and from that, he then goes on to make other houses for George Howard up in the because the Howards, of course, they also owned an estate on this Castle Howard, but they also owned in Cumbria, Narwhal's Castle.
Sure.
And they go, but I think I must say with Philip Webb and Maurice is the fact that you've got the whole package.
Yeah.
So Webb would design the house, and Maurice and Co. Edwin Bone Jones at all, they would actually design the interiors.
Right, okay.
So it's a very clever commercial operation.
Yeah.
That it's a total work of art.
Yeah.
You know, that you get the whole everything. There's nothing from outside coming in. And this is the interesting thing that they are, whereas George Howard is, of course, an aristocracy, but many of the people they're designing for are wealthy industrialists.
Right.
So we've got there's a fabulous house in the Lake District, Blackwell, Bowness on Windermere, and that's made for a Manchester brewery owner, and that's his summer home, much like Stannon is made for a wealthy, well, again, upper middle class solicitor.
Yeah.
It's a lovely country home. So this is what is the downside, is that whereas the idea is to make it that it's wonderful that people are getting joy from what they're making. And so the craftsman is the fact that it takes so many man hours and woman hours, of course, the tapestry, to make something.
Yeah.
But the cost is, well, it can only be afforded by the very rich.
Right.
And so you're actually, you're not defeating the purpose, but you're actually not making it available to all.
So you wouldn't have had people from the working classes living in a house adorned with William Morris designed products.
No, and because they couldn't afford it, because he insisted on handmade.
Yeah.
And
his would that have been the same at the beginning? Would he have liked to have seen that, do you think?
Yes, I think very much so.
Yeah.
He realised at the end he was defeated by the fact that he wanted it, the arts and crafts for all.
But he brought us on to my next question quite nicely now, because this wasn't just about design, was it? There was almost like a real social reform aspect to this movement, wasn't
there? Yes, absolutely. And you see that, I mean, I'm Joan Hibbert, but you see that in the guilds, to say that they form, that Ashby, who took the arts and crafts to America, but Ashby, when he came down from university, he went to Toynbee Hall, you know, in the East End of London,
right, yeah.
Which was for very poor, I mean, the sort of wretched area, the East End of London, in the 18, well, the whole time, really, from the 1850s particularly. But Toynbee Hall was to actually help people, the poorest people of the area, and they would teach them. And he lectured on Ruskin.
Yeah.
The same thing, Stones of Venice and Nature of Gothic. And he thought to himself, well, actually, I would like to do this. I would like to have a commune of like-minded people, and we could make things. And he started with himself, three people put £50 into it to make a guild, the Guild of Handicraft. And it started in the East End, and by the end of the century, I think, well, he had 70. And then when the lease ran out in 1902, they moved to Chipping Campden, 150, sort of on their bicycles. I presume they got the train to the nearest place. But they moved absolutely everybody, 150 families, to the Cotswolds.
Okay, it's fine. Now we turn back to Standen, which is obviously the house we're in at the moment. What makes this such a great example of an arts and craft movement-inspired house?
I think, for a start, is that Webb, in particular...
So this is Philip Webb, the designer.
Philip Webb is the designer. This is his last house. Philip Webb didn't just design the house. If you go into the house, you'll find the glass is made by Webb. You'll find that the wood in the dining room to carve meat, to put the plates on, is also designed by Webb. It's a total work of art.
So you've really micromanaged this place. So
absolutely. Yeah. Of course, it means he's controlling it. And here, well, it's said that, of course, his original ideas incorporated having a library, which was going to be rather expensive, although it's also said that the owner, the Beale family, James Beale, that they thought they didn't really need that. They had a house in Holland Park in London.
Yeah.
This was their summer home.
Right.
But you are talking immensely wealthy, upper middle class people.
Yeah.
And so he's built a family home for James Beale and his children to come to at the weekends or during the summer. And so, of course, for the men, there is a billiard room. For the ladies, there's a morning room. And so every room has a purpose. And so when he was designing the house, he went through it with Mrs. Beale. What is it that you want? And Mr. Beale, what is it that you want? And he designed the house around their needs.
And what kind of people are the Beales then? Am I right saying they made their money from...
Well, he was a solicitor and MP, but yes, the family made it from the railways and were also instrumental in getting the Midland rail network coming into St Pancras.
Yeah.
So a wealthy family. And he lived in, I think he lived in Bedford or Birmingham, but he moved to London to actually control this side of the Beale family and this side of the business, and that's how they ended up coming here, because the railway came to East Grinstead, and so of course then they'd get a pony and trap from the station to the house.
Right, so we're in the something called the Dog Leg Corridor at Standen House, and we're standing next to a piece of wallpaper designed by William Morris. Rosalind, could you tell us a bit more about that, please?
Yes, absolutely. Morris wanted to make everything in the house, or, you know, everything. And so he wanted to make the wallpapers as much as the tapestries. And so he started designing, and he actually painted this design. He realised he wasn't a phenomenal artist of people, but he could do small sections. And so here, the trellis paper is beautiful, and it's actually taken from his rose garden at the Red House in Bexley, the first house, his first marital home. And here we see this wonderful trellis, on the trellis, the roses creeping through, and lovely bluebirds sitting on the trellis, coming through, looking down, up, flying around. But what you see behind it, really, what you can see, what you can't see, is in fact it's handmade. Well, you can see here because it's beautiful. But this takes a block of colour for the pink, for the green, for the trellis. And so it's hugely time-consuming and so immensely expensive to make. But he insisted that it had to be handmade. And so when we're standing in this dogleg corridor, which leads from the dining room through to the kitchens, and the dogleg is, you know, is so that you can't, the smells don't carry, is the vast quantity of handmade paper that we're walking through, and how much this must have cost, you know, to the time, the man hours to produce it, and the cost to the Beale family to actually purchase it. So it's just, this is one of them, but this is one of the earliest ones, I think, painted at the end of the 1860s, into production into the 1870s. He had Wardle and Co. make it for him, and they'd be back and forth to make sure that it was exactly as he wanted it. And then later, in the 1880s, he started producing his own papers.
So, Rosalind, we're in the morning room at Standen House now. And what can you tell us about this room?
Well, this was for the ladies of the house. The men had the billiards room, and, of course, they had a withdrawing room off that for the men. And here, this room was the morning room for the ladies, and here they would meet, they would embroider, sew. It's heard no novels before midday, probably not adhered to. But it's a very feminine room. It has two aspects, a double window aspect overlooking the garden, the vegetable garden, and out over to the wonderful views over the across the hills. And the walls themselves are, well, as I say, they're covered in. They are wall hangings. They're not to keep out the cold, but they are a tapestry. They are fabric. They're William Morris fabric. But the tapestry looks like hangings from the medieval era when you'd have wall hangings to keep out the drafts. And here, instead of wallpaper, he's actually decorated the walls with fabric. And so it's a continuation of the curtains going around the room. And it makes it a very, very enclosed space, very intimate.
That was Rosalind Ormiston and Spencer Mizzen on location at Standen House. For more details, please visit nationaltrust.org.uk. And now it's time for this week's history news with our website assistant, Eddie Cawthorne.
It has been announced that Buckingham Palace is to undergo a £369 million refurbishment funded by the taxpayer. Over the next 10 years, the Royal Residence, which has been the official home of Britain's monarchs since 1837, is due to have its pipes, boilers and electrical systems replaced while remaining open. Staff state that the majority of the palace's mechanical and electrical systems have not been updated for more than 40 years, leading to serious concerns about the risk of water or fire damage to the palace and its art collection. Tony Johnstone Burt, Master of the Queen's Household, stated that by undertaking the repairs now, the palace will hopefully, quote, avert a much more costly and potentially catastrophic building failure in the years to come. In other news, a 400-year-old set of dentures has been discovered by archaeologists in a monastery tomb in Tuscany. Made from human teeth held together by a gold band, the dentures are the first to be discovered from this historical period. Researchers stated that, although there were descriptions of similar objects in texts from the period, there is no known archaeological evidence. They added that the find is, quote, a valuable addition to the history of dentistry. Meanwhile, a sapphire-studded medieval ring has been uncovered in a field in Derbyshire. Dating back to 1250, the solid gold ring was found by an anonymous treasure hunter who described the discovery as, quote, a heart-in-the-mouth moment. Experts have suggested that the ring probably belonged to a high-status figure, perhaps a bishop or a particularly wealthy clergyman. It will be sold at auction next week and is expected to fetch around £2,000.
Well, that's about it for this week's episode, but please do listen in next time when we'll be talking about the attack on Pearl Harbor and the history of physics.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.